From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.
There's a lot of emotions from the lows of, you know, not playing great to the highs of playing great. And then finally, you know, the end, just the night I'll never forget.
Nor will any of Tom Brady's fans as New England celebrates the Patriots' historic Super Bowl win against Atlanta last night. Also today, President Trump's immigration actions and local impacts. A tech CEO says a huge swath of his employees flooded the lines for a recent conference call for legal advice.
10% of the company dialed in.
Wow.
These were people from China, Mexico, countries unaffected. They're just worried.
And language and the Trump administration. Is it political speech or propaganda?
I think that we've shifted into an authoritarian propaganda moment in the United States. The strategy he has employed has been authoritarian in nature.
That's all coming up next on Radio Boston. First, the news.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and let's listen one more time, everyone, just because it feels so good.
Toss to White. He's in! Patriots win the Super Bowl! Brady has his fifth! What a comeback!
That's the call, courtesy of Fox, of the New England Patriots' historic Super Bowl victory last night. For everyone who loves the thrill of victory and the agony of defeat storyline in any great sports event, and yes, shout out there to ABC of the 1980s, last night's 34-28 Pats win had it all. The first overtime in Super Bowl history, a comeback against seemingly impossible odds, and as coach Bill Belichick said today, a team that proved once and for all they are the kings of crunch time.
I think eventually all those plays that we ran on offense, that our conditioning paid off and our mental toughness paid off. We were able to have good execution at the most critical time in the game. And that's really what, you know, where champions are decided is how well you play under pressure in critical situations.
Quarterback Tom Brady picked up his record fourth MVP trophy today, an award that Brady said should have gone to running back James White. Brady was visibly emotional after the game last night, and today he said why. It's because of his mother, Galen Brady, who's been fighting cancer for a year and a half, but was in Houston to watch her son.
All families go through challenging times, personally, but, she has a lot of support and a lot of love, and just happy last night to be able to celebrate with her. And, she hadn't been to a game all year, so what a hell of a game for her to be at.
Hell of a game indeed. Joining us now is Shira Springer, WBUR sports and society reporter. She's in Houston. And Shira, did you think at all that last night's game could have gone the way that it did?
No, not at all, especially considering the way things started. The Patriots were just so out of sync offensively. And to be quite honest, Brady was playing really poorly. I mean, this is a guy who had only two interceptions during the regular season, and then he throws a reception and it's returned for a touchdown. I mean, there were so many things that were not going the Patriots' way, and they fell behind, and they fell behind by as many as 25 points. There was no way that I thought personally they were going to come back, even with Brady.
Well,
as quarterback.
Yeah, and I think that's what a lot of folks were wondering. Like, in the first half, who were the guys out on the field? Like, they'd never seen these Patriots because they were so unlike how they'd played in the rest of the season. And then the Falcons then, like, it's almost as if a switch got turned off for them in the latter part of the second half.
Yeah, it was really strange. It was sort of, like, surreal on the other side of the ball with the Falcons because you had a team that looked like it was just going to romp toward a title get really, really tense. And I think that's where experience comes in. I think you have in Tom Brady a quarterback. This was his seventh Super Bowl. He knows what the pressure feels like. He knows how to do those late game drives. And we all know what happened in overtime.
Yeah. It's knowing what to do in those critical pressure situations, as Bill Belichick said in that cut we played. But here's the thing. I feel like a lot of people maybe had a wobbling of their faith in the Patriots, right? Because I was hearing about a lot of people like leaving or turning off the game in the fourth quarter because the Pats were down by so much. And even apparently President Donald Trump left where he was viewing the game in Florida. But you were sitting with a group of Pats fans in NRG Stadium. What was that like?
The group next to me, you know, they kind of tried to buck each other up and cheer each other on. And you could tell when it was, you know, the most dire, when the team, when the Patriots were down by 25 points, they were kind of looking at each other and saying, okay, just sort of one touchdown. Let's get some momentum here. And they were right. It just took one touchdown and sort of for the offense to get in sync and to get on a roll again and to build some confidence. And that's also what it took for Atlanta to get tight. But you could see them, they were just up and down and they were pulling their hair out at different parts of the game. That being said, I don't think any of them thought that the game would result in the comeback and the finish that they saw. I mean, they were in total shock at the end of the game. And I was watching the players, the Patriots players go out, you know, Matthew Slater go out for the coin toss at the beginning of overtime. And I they seemed to be a little bit shocked on their faces as well. Like, I can't believe we're here and playing for a title in overtime.
Yeah. I mean, so were those fans that you were looking at, like, did they practically pass out in joy when the Pats won?
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, that's a pretty apt description. I mean, they just didn't know what to do with themselves, and then they were running around, and they, you know, I mean, you could tell these were real diehard fans because they had jerseys that sort of spanned the entire history of the franchise. So, you know, you had your Ty Law jerseys and your Gronkowski jerseys. You know, I mean, it was the whole kind of breadth of the Super Bowl runs represented there, and yeah, they pretty much lost it.
Well, so you mentioned history there, Shira. I mean, let's talk about the history that was made by Tom Brady and Bill Belichick. Record holders for Super Bowl wins. I mean, this, I guess there's no question. This puts them right there at the top of the greats list.
Yeah, 100%. I mean, I don't think you can look at it any other way. I mean, I think you have to say, first of all, that Tom Brady is the greatest NFL quarterback of all time. And I think you have to make a very strong, or you can make a very strong argument that he's the greatest NFL player of all time. And I think you can say the same with regard to coaching and Bill Belichick, greatest NFL coach of all time. That being said, though, without each other, I don't think either would have had the same amount of success.
Well, Shira, it's interesting because at today's press conference, Brady referred to a couple of other football greats out of San Francisco. Here's what Brady said.
Steve Young and Joe Montana were my idols, and they still are. So every time I get around either of them, you know, I get, you know, just excited to see them.
Yeah, Joe Montana is a childhood idol of Brady. So I think every opportunity he gets, he likes to mention Joe Montana. But I think he's himself is a little bit almost starstruck that he's bypassed now Joe Montana as the greatest quarterback of all time, and also bypassed him in terms of accolades, because with his four Super Bowl MVP awards, he has one more than Montana.
Interesting. And Joe Montana has four Super Bowl wins total, right?
Yes.
And Brady's
got his
fifth. Yeah.
Exactly.
Let's go back here for a second, Shira, because we should just mention this is the first time a Super Bowl has gone into overtime, right?
Yeah, it was funny. I think it was Fox Sports that tweeted out when it went into overtime. They were the broadcasters of the game, and they said, to be totally transparent here, we'd prepared for a lot of contingencies in this game, but overtime wasn't one of them. I think, you know, it had never happened before, as you said, and it was completely shocking. And I don't think at any point during, you know, the third quarter or even early in the fourth quarter did anyone anticipate that the Patriots would be able to tie it up in regulation. Yeah. It wasn't until, you know, that final drive that people were like, oh my God, this is going to happen.
Yeah. Well, I mean, so given the history-making nature of this game, I imagine that anything physical connected to the game is going to be some pretty hot property, right? Jerseys, things like that?
Yeah. I think everybody in New England and probably around the country has heard by now that Brady had his jersey stolen after the game. He's still trying to locate it.
Right out of his bag in the locker room?
Yes. Yes. And the interesting thing is it's a very controlled group that gets in there. It's not like they're letting everybody into the locker room. So there were, you know, a very small number of people who could have had access to his bag in the locker room and had an opportunity to take it. At his press conference this morning, he put out a call. He said, you know, hey, if anybody sees it on eBay, let me know. So something tells me, though, I don't think it'll be popping up there.
Well, as for Tom Brady's jersey, I'm guessing that it's going to end up at the same place the stolen Gardner Museum paintings are. We will never see it again.
Oh, I don't know. I'm keeping my eye on Vladimir Putin in Russia. along with it, he's going to add to his Super Bowl collection, right? He has one ring, and now he might have a Brady jersey to add to it.
Shira Springer, get yourself on that airplane. Get back to Boston. Shira is WBUR Sports and Society reporter. She's been reporting tirelessly all of last week and today about the Patriots' historic win in Super Bowl LI. Shira, it's been so great to talk with you. Thanks so much.
Thanks for having me on.
Okay, fans, we know you watched the game last night. What do you think of it? What do you make of the Patriots' Super Bowl comeback, of this history-making game? What do you think about the empire that Tom Brady and Bill Belichick have built at Foxborough? Call us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK to give us your thoughts on the Patriots and the Super Bowl. You can also send us a tweet at Radio Boston. Well, joining us now are a couple of other voices who watched the game breathlessly last night. Jim McBride, he covers the Patriots for the Boston Globe. He joins us from Houston. Jim, welcome to the show.
Oh, thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
It's great to have you. Also with us is Sean Glennon. He's author of many books on the Patriots, including Tom Brady versus the NFL, The Case for Football's Greatest Quarterback. Sean, welcome to you.
Thanks for having me, Magna.
It's great to have both of you. So, Jim, I mean, you were there. You're still there in Houston now. You heard what Shira Springer had to say. Do you feel the same way? Was this kind of one for the ages?
Well, certainly it's going to go down in Boston sports history as probably the greatest event in the history of the game, really. You have the Red Sox winning the World Series in 2004. You have the Patriots beating the Seahawks 2 years ago, and then this one. So I think you take your pick out of those three, and you can't really lose.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. The Sox sent out a tweet today of showing pictures of people signing the truck day truck, and they said, and it's got there's a photograph here of someone saying, "Oh, go Sox, bring it home, Pats win," and the Boston Red Sox tweeted out, "We've got some work to do." So we're sort of handing the torch from one franchise to the other. Sean Glennon, you have been following the Patriots for a long, long time. Did you think that we'd see a moment like we did see last night?
No, I've been following football for a long time, and I'm still sort of in shock today that we saw the moment that we saw last night. I think you probably have to go back to the 1958 NFL Championship game to witness anything that's anywhere close to what we saw last night.
Okay, so for those of us who don't remember 1958, remind me.
Well, it's called the greatest game ever played, and it's sort of the game that made NFL football the TV sensation in America that it is today.
Yeah. Okay, interesting. So, Jim, I have a question for you. Earlier in the conversation with Shira, we heard a clip from Bill Belichick talking about how really what he thinks the Patriots proved in the game yesterday was that they are the masters of staying together and keeping focused during crunch time. He talked about their mental toughness. He talked about their focus. Is that really how this team distinguishes itself?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I talked to a number of players last night, and at halftime, I was asking them all what their mindset was. After the game, what was the mindset at halftime? And they all said we weren't doubting ourselves. We were just disappointed in the way we played, and we knew that if we got our opportunity in the second half, we could make it happen. Now, you know, of course, it's easy to look back and say that, but several guys pointed to safety De'Ron Harmon as he was riding an exercise bike in the locker room at halftime to keep loose, and he was shouting out, "This is going to be the greatest comeback in the history of the NFL." And, you know, sometimes you take that as hyperbole, but when the number of guys tell you the same story, then you know it's pretty true. And then we talked to Bill this morning, and he confirmed that story. So, I think these guys, you know, maybe a little shell shock, but they never doubted themselves, and I think that's where the mental toughness comes in.
Sean,
over the last 2 weeks, Bill talked about two things relentlessly: the Falcon speed and his team's mental toughness, and you saw both of them on display last night. The speed of the Falcons in the first half, and the Patriots' mental toughness in the second half.
Oh, interesting. So, Sean Glennon, piggyback off what Jim's saying there. I mean, I love that story of of Patriots' toughness during halftime, even in the locker room.
Yeah, I think it's a great story, and clearly it's a true story. It's the kind of story that Jim and I both sort of make our livings telling. I think that, you know, when I hear that, I think that's the kind of thing that becomes a story because they pay it off, right? I mean, that's the kind of thing you're supposed to say in the locker room at halftime of the Super Bowl when you're down that many points. If you got guys in there who aren't saying that, who don't still believe in their team, then you don't really have a football team. So it's only when they actually go out and do it, which has obviously never happened before in the Super Bowl, that you hear about that stuff.
Yeah, well, we are talking about the New England Patriots and their historic come-from-behind victory last night in Super Bowl 51. You can call us with your thoughts at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. By the way, I mean, regardless of how anyone feels, I think last night's win was something that we could all rally around, which is a nice change for America here. We've got some tweets coming in. Ezra Dunkel-Pollier, and Ezra, forgive me if I pronounce your name wrong, but he sent us a tweet saying, hard to argue with five rings and that many comebacks. Yes, best QB ever. And Cart sent us this tweet saying, I'm still in shock about exactly what happened yesterday. Hashtag SB51. Sean Glennon, let me ask you, actually, Sean and Jim, the question for you both. So both Bill Belichick and Tom Brady have five Super Bowl rings now. Bill Belichick has two more on top of that. Could this empire, this franchise, be built the way it has been without the two of them together?
I don't believe so. No, I think, you know, and if you look back at the history of great quarterbacks and great coaches in the NFL, you see it time and again. You see Lombardi and Bart Starr. You see Bill Walsh and Joe Montana. You see Paul Brown and Otto Graham, and I could keep going. George Halas and Sid Luckman. You know, it's just these pairings come together, and you have to just sort of hit it right, and then you get a situation like we've had with the Patriots. I don't think we've ever seen it this good before, but it's sort of the way it has to come together.
Yeah. So, Jim, what is it about the two of them that makes it work so well?
I think they have so many things in common. Their work ethic, their attention to detail. Their desire to win and their desire to compete is at such a high level, and they just don't want to lose. Now, I think if they weren't together, they probably both would have achieved a level of success in this league, but I don't think you're talking five Super Bowl championships unless the two of these guys are together.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, we're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. We're talking about the Patriots and would love to hear from you. You saw the game. You experienced it. You survived it. What do you make of the victory the Patriots had last night and what it means for New England sports writ large? Again, we're at 800-423-TALK. Let's go to Jose, who's calling from Methuen. You're on the air, Jose.
Thank you so much for taking my call.
You're welcome. What's your thought?
Yes, the thought is that I think it would be a great idea if we could just give some kudos to Jimmy Garoppolo's. The first two games that Tom Brady was out because of his sanctions, he did put a little bit of a pebble in the career of this year's Patriots game. I am a true Patriots fan, and I've been a Patriots fan for the last, I'd say, almost 25 years. Even from when I used to live in the Dominican Republic, I would follow the game. And Montana, he was one of the greatest. But now we have Tom Brady as the greatest. It is amazing. I'm still shaking.
Jose, thank you so much for your call there. Jim McBride, Jose also reminding us about Jimmy Garoppolo.
Yeah, you know, Jimmy's he was great this year. He came in, we won that game against the Cardinals, and he was really lights out against the Dolphins until he got hurt, you know, so they really didn't skip a beat. But I think where Jimmy's greatest value was this year, as it's been the last 2 years, was his ability to run the scout team in practice and mimic the whoever the quarterback was that they were going to play that week. He would play that role in practice to get the defense ready. And to a man, the offense always said, Jimmy, you know, I mean, the defense would always say, Jimmy gave us great looks. And, you know, he was lauded 2 years ago as a rookie for mimicking Russell Wilson. And, you know, he's just an underrated athlete. And, you know, he's got a bright future ahead of him.
Sean Glennon, your thoughts?
Yeah, I think, you know, I could agree with what Jim just said, and I think it's interesting to me to when you look at Tom Brady. He was another guy who, as a as a rookie, was lauded for running the scout team well. And so there's a great history of that happening with this Patriots team. And we know that Jimmy has looked like Tom in a lot of ways, and I think he's probably going to go off to wherever it is, San Francisco, Cleveland, and look like Tom again. I think he was great those first two games. One of the things that I've been looking at today is the fact that Tom Brady is the only quarterback in the 2016 season and postseason to win 14 games, and he did it suspended the first 4 weeks of the season. And I think it's a lot of that has to do with the fact that he came in to a team that that was able to mature, an offense that was able to mature, and just pick things up. And Jimmy deserves a lot of credit for setting that stage.
Yeah. Gentlemen, this makes me think that we should obviously make mention of the fact that NFL Commissioner Roger Goodell was at the Super Bowl, of course, and also handed Tom Brady that MVP trophy. Looking back now, does the last night's win sort of just make the whole Deflategate scandal laughable all over again? Or like, how do we look back on Deflategate given the historic victory of the Patriots last night, Jim?
I think for Roger Goodell and the NFL offices, Deflategate ended when Tom Brady gave up the fight. I don't think Tom Brady gave up Deflategate until last night. So now I think you can say both sides have kind of buried the hatchet, and that's the way it's going to go down now.
And Sean, your thought on that?
Well, yeah, I think Jim is right, but I also think Tom Brady has certainly, with his performance since the Deflategate game, really shown what a joke that whole scandal or quote unquote scandal was. The guy's won two Super Bowls. He's been the MVP of both of those Super Bowls. His if you go through his career stats, and I won't bore you with that, but they're better since halftime in that Deflategate game by far than they were than they are for his career as a whole, and that they were before that. There was nothing there, and I understand why Tom didn't finish fighting. I think fans in New England will always wish that he had kept up the fight, but I do think last night allows everybody to sort of let it go and move on.
Let's take a couple quick calls, see if I can squeeze them in here. Padma is calling from Shrewsbury. You're on the air.
Oh, hi. I just had a comment. We are so elated about the historical win. And I just wanted to comment about the mental and probably the psychological preparation of the team, and also to compare that with the recent Australian Open where Federer won after, I think, about 5 years. I think it's the mental preparation that really helps these teams come back after a deficit of 25 mm-hmm. points. So that's what I really... wonder how they prepare for this mental toughness.
Padma, actually, good question. Jim, can you give us a tiny window into how you get as tough mentally as the Patriots are?
I think just being through it the number of times and maybe failing a few times and learning from those failures is a way to do it. I think also the preparation of the older players who have been through it and can tell the younger players what to expect. It's not always the performance that shows up in experience. It's that mental toughness that's been telling these kids, this is a big week, this is what to expect. When the chips get down, don't give up. We still have Tom Brady, so that helps a lot in mental preparation when he's your quarterback.
So experience, mentorship, all key parts of the mental toughness put on display by the Patriots last night. Last quick question for both of you, because we're fast out of time here. How much longer can this dynasty last, Sean? How long do you think?
Oh, God. We started hearing reports yesterday about the Patriots extending Brady in the weeks ahead for another 3 years. And, Tom talks about wanting to play into his mid-40s, and I have always doubted it. I've always said there's no way. The great ones never know when it's time to go, and he'll play, and he'll get awful. But this guy keeps proving me wrong. He proved me wrong in 2001 when I thought Bledsoe should get his job back. He proved me wrong in Super Bowl 49 when I said you can't come back from 10 down to the Seahawks. He proved me wrong again last night. So, 6-7 years from now when he's still playing at a high level, I'll have to say he proved me wrong again.
Here's knock on wood, right? Jim McBride, your thought?
I think as long as that chip is on his shoulder, you're going to see him playing and playing at a high level. Obviously, Father Time is going to catch up to him at some point, but I don't see either one of these guys, Belichick or Brady, losing their fire anytime soon. You know, Bill kind of talked about retirement this morning when he was asked, and he said, look, you know, my focus is on next year and not really anything more than that. So they both love to still compete, and they both love to show up and work. And I think they have as much fun in practice as they do during games. And when you get guys like that, it's a pretty good combination.
Well, Jim McBride covers the Patriots for the Boston Globe. He's speaking to us today from Houston. Jim, thanks so very much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
And Sean Glennon, author of many books on the Patriots, including Tom Brady versus the NFL, The Case for Football's Greatest Quarterback. Sean, it was really great to have you. Thanks so much.
Thank you so much for having me on.
Back in a moment. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. The Massachusetts tech sector is among the industries leading the pushback against President Donald Trump's executive orders on immigration. Those orders temporarily halted visas from seven mostly Muslim countries and all refugees coming into the United States. At the forefront of that charge, Muhammad Ali. He's the CEO and president of Carbonite, a computer security and data backup company. Ali is also a board member of the Massachusetts Technology Leadership Council. And he's an immigrant himself. He says sudden immigration restrictions of the type called for by President Trump could have a devastating impact on the tech sector.
Yeah, the sector is highly dependent on skilled workers, and we actually have a huge gap in the tech sector, as much as a million jobs that are not being filled in the tech sector. And any further restriction on either local development of talent through our education system or external acquisition of talent through immigration process will hinder our tech sector in a way that will be damaging to our economy.
Now, when you say a million, is that a million jobs nationwide or?
It's a million jobs nationwide. Mm.
Take me down to the level of the work you do at Carbonite. Has there been any impact or shifting in the mood at the company?
Oh, absolutely. We have employees who came to the United States to go to college. We've hired them. They're now concerned about whether if they go visit their families, they're going to be able to come back. I mean, some of these employees aren't even from these seven countries. Like, we actually had a telecon for all employees, all 800 or so in the United States, to talk to one of our immigration lawyers. 10% of the company dialed in.
Wow.
These were people from China, Mexico, countries unaffected. They're just worried.
And what effect does that worry have on your ability to do business?
Well, they're distracted, right? Mm-hmm. And so there's a productivity hit right there. But also, I have an employee who's going home to his brother's wedding, and he's worried about his ability to come back. If he's unable to come back, we actually have a plan. We're going to send him to one of our European offices. So if we have issues with this immigration order, we will actually increase our employment in our European and Canadian offices, which is not good for America. We do not want to do this to the American economy.
Interesting. Basically, you're having to come up with contingency plans now.
That's right.
Huh.
And it's not just us. It's almost every tech company out there.
Wow. Well, let me ask you, regardless of how the legal dispute over the executive orders shakes out, are you concerned about the long-term impact of the decisions made by the Trump administration for one particular reason? And that is, there's really, it seems to me, a global battle for the top tech talent. And that unlike a generation or two ago, the very people you seek to hire, these days, there's a lot of places they can go. They can go to Canada. They can go to Europe. They can go to Asia. Do you think the United States risks being a less welcoming place overall for those people?
I mean, not only do we risk that, it is an imminent danger even before the Trump administration. These two industries, tech and life science in particular, which are becoming huge growth engines, not just for Massachusetts, but for the entire country, if we impede them today and we start falling backwards, it's actually going to have tremendous long-term damage to the not only Massachusetts economy, because we are particularly affected given our extra reliance on tech and life sciences, but the whole country.
Interesting. And, you know, I'll throw in higher ed as well, because you mentioned that you have a lot of employees who came here, got their degrees, and stayed.
Right.
Is there a concern that we're going to see a lot of students come here, get their degrees, and then not stay, either because they can't or no longer want to?
Yes. You know, I have two employees right now. One of them came up to me on Monday, and she said, my parents are Iranian. They came to Canada. I was born in Canada. You know, she's in her mid-20s. She's an amazing employee. But I'm sort of worried. If I go back to visit my parents, am I going to have trouble at the airport? Because, well, technically, I'm not affected by this rule, right? Mm-hmm. But if you think about it, I'm a green card holder, and ancestrally, I'm Iranian. So this has caused trouble. And so, yeah, I think people are going to be concerned about their stability of being able to travel. And if they are unable to travel freely or worried about it, then some of those people may go to places where they are great jobs. Canada and Europe, there are great jobs there. And companies like ours will hire there.
Yeah. I'd like to explore something with you, because I heard you say about there's a million unfilled jobs in the tech sector across the country. I would think, in fact, I know that there are many people who support and voted for the president who say, there are American employees right now who could fill those jobs. And in fact, that's one of the reasons why they support Donald Trump, because he might be using a wrecking ball in terms of his executive orders. But what he's saying is that we should look right here in within the United States for the talent to fill the jobs needed
in
the tech sector.
Absolutely. I completely agree with you. Now, let me give you some stats. Here in Massachusetts, we graduate 65,000 students from high school per year. 35,000 of those students go on to get some sort of post-secondary degree. 30,000 do not, right? So if we really want to address this talent gap, we will invest in our K-12 system and skills retraining. That is absolutely the solution going forward. And I just don't see, actually, our state government investing in this, mm-hmm. and certainly our federal government is not indicating that that's the solution that they want. And then if you look at things like H-1Bs, we're talking about a max 85,000 visas out of a million open slots. So this is just a little bit of a drop in the bucket. But if we get rid of that drop in the bucket and we don't fill it with local talent grown through our education system, then we have a real problem.
Mm-hmm. I see. So tell me a little bit about your story, right? Because your perspective as the CEO and a leader in the tech sector in Massachusetts is much appreciated. But also, I mean, you yourself are an immigrant.
I am an immigrant.
How old were you when you came to the United States?
So I came to the United States when I was 11.
What brought your family to the United States?
Opportunity. You know, like everybody else, they come to America for opportunity. It's a great land of opportunity.
Yeah. And what did your parents do?
My dad was a mechanic, uh-huh. and my mom worked in a fabric store. I mean, they were poor. You know, we could barely make ends meet. So.
And you grew up then in Queens?
In
is that
Queens.
Right? And tell me, what was that like?
Well, Queens is a little bit of a tough place. you learn a lot. But Queens is also a multicultural mecca, and I loved it. I love growing up in an environment where there were people from all parts of the world. It gave me an opportunity to see the world in a microcosm.
Because of all the people that you were
all
surrounded
by. All the diversity.
By. Yeah. Now, I've read that that you went to a pretty tough high school. Is that right?
Junior high school.
Junior high school. Okay.
So
gotta get them right.
I'm not sure if the stat is right or not, but at one point I was told that it was the second worst junior high school in all of the state of New York. But, you know, I mean, it was junior high school. It was education.
So what got you on the path to tech then?
So there was a teacher. I think her name was Mrs. Schiff. And one day she said to me, hey, you know, I have this computer. If you want to come in the morning and play with it, you're welcome to. And I did. And I started learning how to use it and how to program. You know, I was from a pretty poor background. And the fact that this teacher reached out to me and gave me this opportunity was pretty phenomenal. And from that, I became interested in computers, and I learned more and more and more. And here today I am, you know, at the head of a computer company.
She set you down the path then.
She did.
Well, Muhammad Ali, going forward then, I mean, there's a lot of uncertainty still, and that is going to be worked out through the legal system. But what would you like to see happen? I mean, would you like to see these executive orders entirely overturned?
I would like to see the executive order entirely overturned. We are all concerned about security. There are many of us who are willing to assist in coming up with appropriate measures that will secure our country, yet at the same time not put our economy at jeopardy.
So if you had the opportunity to speak to the president or members of his administration, what would you tell them?
I think if I had the opportunity to speak to the president or his administration, I would tell them that there are many people out here in business who are ready to do the thoughtful thing, and that he and they should sit and listen carefully and deliberate before taking action. What we've seen in the last few weeks is quick action without much deliberation.
Well, Muhammad Ali is the president and CEO of Carbonite. He also serves on the board of Oxfam America and the Massachusetts Technology Leadership Council. A true pleasure to speak with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Back in a moment. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This morning, President Donald Trump tweeted this, quote, "Any negative polls are fake news. Just like the CNN, ABC, NBC polls in the election. Sorry, people want border security and extreme vetting," end quote. So let's just think about that for a moment. The president of the United States declared that he does not accept any negative polls as a reality. That the only polls he believes, and by extension, the only polls he thinks you should believe, are the ones that put him in a positive light. Well, that's one example of why Jason Stanley thinks the United States has entered into a new era of political propaganda. Stanley is a professor of philosophy at Yale University. He's also author of How Propaganda Works, and he joins us today from WNPR in New Haven. Professor Stanley, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you so much.
So a new era of political propaganda, how does what Donald Trump talks about or how he talks about it differ from what we've seen for several hundred years?
Well, there are continuities. I mean, the goal of all party propaganda is to make your allegiance to a political party like your allegiance to the Patriots, where, you know, you don't really think, you just follow. But the Democrats and the Republicans have long done that. There are people who will vote for the Republicans or the Democrats no matter what. But typically, allegiance is to the ideals these parties represent. And at our best, our politics is an open dialogue about the conflict, if such there be, between liberty and equality, our two great democratic values. But it really looks like when Trump talks about the movement, mm-hmm. what he's talking about is allegiance to him, allegiance to Trump.
Well, so let me ask you just in more detail then. You've written about how you believe your analysis is that the manner of propaganda that Donald Trump uses is along the lines of authoritarian propaganda. So how would you define that?
So it's classically authoritarian propaganda dating back to Plato's Republic in Book 8 when, for example, the previous guest said that the order, the travel ban was not a product of deliberation. I believe it was a product of deliberation. As Plato says in Book 8, it's necessary for a tyrant to always be stirring up war. And Plato also says the first thing an authoritarian does is to stir up a war. So I think the ban is meant to sort of be provocative and to, like, constantly keep people in fear so that he can represent himself as he said in his RNC speech, as the only solution.
So tell me more, though. I mean, if we were to have a sort of a mini bullet list of the things that are the hallmarks of authoritarian propaganda, you named one of them, that is sort of the inviting or stirring up of chaos. What are the other hallmarks?
Dividing us. So the president seems to speak mainly to his supporters and triple down, if anything, upon drawing their support rather than unifying. The second thing would be simply inventing things whole cloth. That's one thing the media really missed out on. I mean, it's popular to show that you have dominance over the truth. That's what an authoritarian does. So the media kept on waiting for him to be punished for that. But his supporters are attracted by that. The supporters are attracted by his open defiance of reality. I mean, Hannah Arendt says in Origins of Totalitarianism, in describing totalitarian propaganda, the mob really believed that truth was whatever respectable society had passed over with corruption. The modern masses do not believe in anything visible or the reality of our own experiences, What convinces masses are not facts, and not even invented facts, but only the consistency of the system of which they are presumably part. And she adds, the main problem with authoritarian propaganda is its open defiance of common sense.
Right. So let me just play a clip here. It's one that's probably familiar to people by now. This is just from a couple of weeks ago when senior administration advisor Kellyanne Conway was pressed by NBC's Chuck Todd about claims that the administration was making about the size of the crowd at President Trump's inauguration and comments that were also later made by Press Secretary Sean Spicer. So here's Chuck Todd tangling with Kellyanne Conway.
Why the president asked the White House press secretary to come out in front of the podium for the first time and utter a falsehood. Why did he do that? It undermines the credibility of the entire White House press office
Don't be so overly dramatic about it, Chuck. You're saying it's a falsehood, and they're giving Sean Spicer, our press secretary, gave alternative facts to that. But the point remains.
Wait a minute. Alternative facts?
So Jason Stanley, I mean, is that exchange making exactly the point that you were making? That what Kellyanne Conway said is exactly what the president's most fervent supporters want to hear, a defiance of those who purport to know reality.
Let me repeat Arendt's words again. What convinces masses are not facts, and not even invented facts, but rather open defiance. The movement is the leader speaks, and you're a follower if you repeat what the leader says. And that's attractive.
Yeah.
That's
so
attractive.
So there's this underlying assumption that this hasn't happened or doesn't happen often in American political discourse. But I wonder about that because, you know, it was the Bush administration, the George W. Bush administration, who famously gave the world that phrase, we're not a reality-based administration.
Absolutely. It started then. And we saw when they sent Colin Powell out to repeat what were lies, that sort of made Colin Powell complicit. You saw General Powell is a very noble man, and it was a very sad moment in our history to see that happen, to see him being sort of forced to be part of this big lie. But yes, as Karl Rove said, you know, we're an empire now. We create our own reality.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, that definitely, the Iraq War, that's why the president is always returning to the Iraq War, right? He's always saying, look, you know, we're not exactly innocent ourselves. Every time he's accused of bending reality, he returns to the Iraq War and says, well, the elites did it too. You know.
Well, so let me just jump in here because you mentioned Colin Powell. We have actually a little bit of tape from General Powell, I guess then Secretary of State Powell's United Nations speech in February of 2003, where he made the case for war to the UN Security Council. And there was a moment where he held up a white vial to the cameras. And he basically made this claim about the chemical warfare capacity that the United States believed Iraq was capable of.
Less than a teaspoonful of dry anthrax in an envelope shut down the United States Senate in the fall of 2001. Iraq declared 8,500 liters of anthrax, but UNSCOM estimates that Saddam Hussein could have produced 25,000 liters. If concentrated into this dry form, this amount would be enough to fill tens upon tens upon tens of thousands of teaspoons.
That's former Secretary of State Colin Powell in 2003. Jason Stanley, I wonder if we could just step back in history a little bit here, because I'm curious. I read that your grandmother, I believe, lived in pre-World War II Germany and wrote a memoir about her time there. And there's some lessons to be drawn from her experience. Tell us about that.
Well, the lessons to be drawn, there are many lessons. I believe that there was the kind of creation of an artificial enemy. In that case, it was the Jewish people, my people. In this case, I fear it's American citizens of Islamic faith. And there were years of provocation. My father was growing up in Berlin as a small child, learning to read the signs. And when he was learning to read, he reported to me that he would read these horrible things, and they were about him. And it took him a while to recognize that he was the enemy. And then at a certain point, Jewish children were excluded from parks, and there was a constant provocation. And the constant provocation led to a terrorist incident, a German Jewish citizen assassinating Ernst von Rath, a German diplomat. And Joseph Goebbels said, the righteous indignation of the German people must be freed. And that was Kristallnacht. And what is happening, I'm concerned. I hope it's not happening. But the Trump administration will have to prove me wrong. I think we have to prepare for the worst. But if, you know, the constant provoking seems to be leading up to a moment of where there would be someone who would behave horrifically and do a terrorist attack, of which there have been many by right-wing extremists, but we're being prepared for someone responding to these provocations violently and then a violent crackdown on our fellow citizens of Islamic faith. That's what concerns me.
Is it really as tenuous as that, or is it? Should we look back to other American presidencies and take heart in the fact that the republic survives regardless of who's in the White House?
I believe in the American people, and I believe that, you know, we will not let our fellow American citizens of Muslim faith down if we are asked to react against them, and I hope we aren't. But I just think that we have to learn from history. And maybe the administration is just out of control and things are just chaotic and not intentionally chaotic. But there's a constant provocation. I mean, Michael Flynn declares Islam the enemy. I mean, put yourself, my family was the enemy. They grew up as children knowing what it is to be the enemy. There are children hearing this. There are children of Muslim faith hearing this. Every American has to put themselves in the mind of a 7-year-old Muslim child and think what it is to hear about the rhetoric that's directed against them.
Well, Jason Stanley, let me ask you, we've just got a minute and a half or so to go. All of what you said makes me wonder if really where we should be focusing our attention is on ourselves. We, the American people, because propaganda, authoritarian or not, only works with the complicity of the people listening to it. And what I'm hearing you say is that people want to hear what the president is saying and how he's saying it, so that instead of looking to him to change, we ought to be looking at each other.
We ought to be looking at each other. I couldn't have said it more directly or more perfectly myself.
And so if that's the case, then how?
We reach out to each to the ones, the our fellow citizens who supported him, who didn't believe what he said, who said, it's always the case that I thought when authoritarians speak, they're always speaking literally. But many of my friends who supported Trump or people I know who supported Trump thought he wasn't speaking seriously. They said, oh, he's just using the stuff about Islam for politics. Well, that's rarely the case. Authoritarians are always pride themselves on action. So we must reach out to our friends who supported Trump and say, just promise me that you won't overreact if and when something tragic like a terrorist attack happens on our soil.
Hmm. Well, Jason Stanley is a professor of philosophy at Yale University. He's author of the book, How Propaganda Works. Jason Stanley, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Well, that's it for today. You know, you can always leave us your thoughts and comments either at our website, radioboston.org, or on Twitter. We're at Radio Boston. Also, we've got a Facebook page as well. That's facebook.com/Radio Boston. That's it for today. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.